Pastor Bertrand L. Tampere.
So tonight I want to talk about God's righteous remnant. All the principal churches teach a message of not the kingdom of God, but what you might call the democracy of God, where everybody is reduced to the dead level of the masses. In other words, as though God had to imitate Kennedy and Johnson. And of course, in that, we know they're completely wrong. Now, to restore a true perspective, the Israel identity message has had to stress the special part played by God's chosen people, Israel, not the Jews, the Anglo-Saxon nations who are the true Israel, that special part above all other nations or races. Now, the difficulty is to avoid unduly emphasizing the national identity and the part that it plays without recognizing that there are even in that some further restrictions. Now, some people have merely narrowed this dead-level democracy idea. Instead of taking in everybody, including the Chinese and the Congolese, why, they take in just Israel, and then they reduce everybody in the nation Israel to this dead level thing. And this is just as wrong, just as misleading as the others. We condemn others for taking a portion of one verse out of context and then founding a doctrine on it, in which case they're always wrong. And we have to make sure that we are not guilty of the same fault. So tonight I want to point out that you shouldn't be misled by some sweeping statements you hear indicating that all you need is just to be an Israelite, and beyond that point the rest of your character doesn't matter. And some of them justify this by quoting Paul, or a portion of a verse of Paul, in Romans 11, verse 26, "And so all Israel shall be saved." And they don't go on with any of the rest of it. Now we have to notice that, first of all, Paul himself misquotes Isaiah 45, verse 17. Paul is letting his enthusiasm run away with him a little bit, because Isaiah does not say all Israel. And secondly, aside from that, even if you just read the rest of that 11th chapter of Romans, you'd see that Paul recognizes that there is just a remnant of Israel who come in for all of these blessings. That a considerable part of the nation of Israel refuse to fit themselves for this, and therefore are not able to get the degree of blessing which otherwise they might have. For example, in this same chapter of Romans, the 11th chapter, verses 2 to 5 and 7, Paul says, "Wot ye not what the Scripture says of Elias? How that he makes intercession to God against Israel, saying, Lord, they have killed thy prophets and digged down thine altars, and I am left alone, and they seek my life. But what says the answer of God unto him? I have reserved to myself 7,000 men who have not bowed the knee to the image of Baal. Even so then, at this present time also, there is a remnant according to the election of grace. What then? Israel hath not obtained that which he seeketh for, but the election has obtained it, and the rest were blinded." Also, some people try to wave off this restriction easily enough by substituting for the word remnant the phrase, "why, all that remain," as though that was a vast multitude. But all that remain is not a proper paraphrase of this word, a remnant, which has a very restrictive meaning. And especially so when you go back to the original Hebrew and Greek words and see what they used. Now, where Paul here in this 11th chapter of Romans says there is a remnant according to the election of grace. The word translated remnant there is the Greek word lima, meaning a few, a remainder. And the derivation of that word lima is from the other Greek word lipo, meaning not merely a few, but it has the meaning to be lacking or insufficient in number. Definitely, emphatically, a few. Now, there have been many times when all Israel was not saved in the past. For example, in the 10th chapter of Leviticus, while Moses was up on Mount Sinai, you remember, after he'd been gone there several days, being instructed by God, the people got impatient and they came to his brother Aaron and they said, we don't know what's become of this man Moses. He's gone somewhere. He told us he was gone to talk to this God Yahweh, but we don't know whether he's coming back or not. Now, you make us some gods to lead us, some idols. So, Aaron, being one of these men who dislike controversy, you understand, he wanted to be popular. He went along with it. He told the people to contribute all their gold jewelry, and he melted it down and cast a couple of golden calves out of it. It's interesting to note what he said when Moses came back and took him to task for it. Well, he said, I put the gold in the fire and, there came out this calf. How surprising. He failed to state who made the mold in which that calf was cast. Well, as Aaron said to Moses, thou knowest the people that they are set on mischief, and they were. And they had to get a lesson. And that first lesson was that 3,000 of their number were killed by God himself. Now, every time we depart from his way of doing things, we mess things up. Today, we don't bother giving any particular teaching to the young, or for that matter, the old, about the necessity of behaving themselves. We wait till after they have violated the law and get caught. Then we say, well, now is the time to try to reform them. And instead of judgment, they get probation, when they're already too hardened to be fit for it. The lesson we teach them is that crime does pay because you can violate the law and get away with it. Now, God goes at it the other way. God says people should be taught thoroughly before they make a misstep. He may give them a warning, but then when it comes time for judgment, then it's too late to get out of it. You either heed God's voice and reform, or if you wait until he comes with the sword, then you must take your medicine. Because when judgment comes, there's no escaping it. Then in the 10th chapter of Leviticus, Nadab and Abihu, who were sons of Aaron, made a mistake. Now, the original fire on the altar had been lighted by God himself. He sent fire from heaven to ignite the wood on the altar. And it was the duty of the priests to keep that same fire going as an eternal fire They were to keep providing fresh fuel, so there would never be any need to relight that fire. And Nadab and Abihu, remember now, were ordained priests, properly selected and ordained. But they thought, oh well, if your intentions are good, who could ask anything better than that? So they brought strange fire, something of their own lighting, and put incense on it to offer incense before God, and he killed them. They were slain by God. That's in the 10th chapter of Leviticus. Well, the people of Israel, you remember, were a nuisance and annoyance to God throughout the entire period of the Exodus. It's strange. They had seen miracles such as could not be worked other than by the direct intervention of God on their behalf. And with that happening before their eyes, with the visible presence of God every day before them, in that pillar of cloud by day and pillar of fire by night, they still couldn't get faith enough to believe him, or even, for that matter, to believe in his existence, apparently. So they were always crabbing about the way that he was managing things. He led them into a wilderness where there was not any food available, no growing crops, and then he provided them with the manna, so they were always fed. And instead of expressing gratitude, they were always complaining about it. Ah, we wish we'd never left Egypt. Back there we had the melons and the leeks and the garlic and so on, and we ate well, and why didn't we stay there where we were well off? So you read in the 11th chapter of Numbers, verses 1 and 2, and when the people complained, it displeased Yahweh, and Yahweh heard it, and his anger was kindled, and the fire of Yahweh burned among them and consumed them that were in the outermost parts of the camp. And the people cried unto Moses, and when Moses prayed unto Yahweh, the fire was quenched. So they weren't all wiped out, but nevertheless, neither was all Israel saved. All Israel weren't willing to do what was necessary to be saved, and some of them had to pay the penalty. So they continued crabbing about not having meat, just this manna. So God said he'd give them meat. He'd give them meat more than they could stand to eat. He'd feed them with it for a whole month till they loathed it. And he sent in quail in vast numbers, so they had no trouble killing plenty of them for their food. But because their attitude wasn't changed at all, with the quail, he sent a great plague, which killed a large number of them. Now, the thing that should set to rest at once any idea that all Israel is saved is when you reach the point where they were ready to start north into the promised land. They halted. They'd gone past the head of the Red Sea, and they halted and they sent half a dozen spies on a 40-day scouting trip through the land. And they came back reporting with great enthusiasm that it was a wonderful land, fertile, rich, the crops were marvelous. But it was heavily populated by people who had strong fortified cities, and there were even some of the descendants of the giants there, and they were afraid of it. So you remember that there were only two, Joshua and Caleb, among the spies who said, well, so what? God is stronger than these heathen. He told us to go in and he'd give us the land, so let's go. The people wouldn't. After all the miracles God had done, they wouldn't believe him. They wouldn't trust him. All Israel saved? No. Out of all Israel, the only two people who were saved to enter the promised land were Joshua and Caleb. And the rest were sent to wander in the wilderness for 40 years until the rest of them were all dead. Even Moses muffed his chance, you know, a little later. Not even Moses was carried all the way into the land. Then there was the rebellion led by Korah. Now, from the beginning, God picked out a selected, chosen few among the whole nation of Israel. The Hebrew word used to describe the entire nation of Israel is Edal. Although you never realize that there's any distinction from reading it in your King James Version, which uses the word assembly and the word congregation practically interchangeably, without regard to which Hebrew word it's derived from. But for this elect group among the nation, a different Hebrew word, kahal, is used. And in the Hebrew, the distinction is always made as to which is being spoken of. Now, the kahal were to furnish the leadership and the priesthood. You remember the first Passover occurred the night before they left Egypt. Now, if ever there was a priestly function to be performed, it was the sacrifice of the Passover lamb. And yet this was done by the kahal. Now, you can't tell that from reading the English translation, which sounds as though every family killed their own Passover lamb and went on ahead with it. But in the Hebrew, it says the kahal shall kill the lamb. Your English translation says in the evening. The Hebrew says between the evenings, which you might explain perhaps as meaning between the time the sun starts downward, a little afternoon, and the time it sets. In other words, in the afternoon. So, the leadership, including especially representing the people in their dealings with God, was a function of this select group, the kahal. Not everybody, not all Israel. So Korah. Now Korah actually himself was entitled to a part, even though a minor one, in the kahal because he was of the tribe of Levi. And the whole tribe of Levi were given priestly functions. Now the one family of Aaron had the high priesthood. And he and his sons remained throughout the year at the temple in Jerusalem. Their service was always at the temple. The rest of the Levites were supposed to be teachers, judges, officials, the entire civil service of the state. And that is the reason why the tribe of Levi was not given any separate land area of their own when the promised land was divided up. There was supposed to be a Levite living in every village of any substantial size anywhere in the entire nation. Now each Levite had his own particular turn when he went to Jerusalem for a two-week period to serve at the temple. It came, I believe, twice per year. That kept him brushed up on ritual and that sort of thing, and he had a chance to be told any further revelations from God that had come there. But then he went back to perform his duties as judge and teacher back in his own hometown. Now here, leading the people of Israel on their march, here were Moses and Aaron. Well, the Bible tells you that for all practical purposes, Moses was king when he was leading them on the march. Because while he didn't have a crown, he actually performed all the functions of command and leadership. And with Aaron, to tell them constantly what was the word of God on this. So this was a more important function than Korah got in on, and he didn't like it. You always find ambitious men who want to get something beyond their capacity. It's another phase of the same thing you find when so often you're annoyed at the fact that the man you have to deal with to do some particular job is usually incompetent. If he had brains enough to do well the job that he's doing, he would have gotten himself a better job that he isn't competent to handle. And that's exactly why he's got himself a better job where he is than he's competent to handle. So here was Korah aspiring to something that was a bit beyond him. So Korah and his accomplices, some 250 of them, important men, heads of families, even among the princely families of the tribes. And they went to Moses and Aaron and they said, "You take too much upon yourself, setting yourself up over the Edah. All the Edah are holy, all of them." They had a very limited function to perform. They weren't in the Kahal at all. They were just the Edah, the rest of the nation. Moses said, "All right, we'll find out who God has chosen to lead us. Tomorrow at this time, you come with censers and incense in them, and Aaron and I will be here before the altar with our censers. We'll see whose incense Yahweh will accept. If he accepts you as his priest, okay, you take over." The next day they came, and they got action fast. Now here were Korah and some 250 people who were the ringleaders in this rebellion. But remember, there were a lot of the other people who didn't do what they ought to have done to put down that rebellion at once. They were ready to go along for the ride, and if Korah could get away with this, they were ready to follow him. Well, God settled it. A great cleft opened up in the earth under them, and Korah and his little conspirator group dropped out of sight in the crack, which closed together again, and that was that for them. But then a plague broke out among the people, those who had been ready to side with Korah if he could get away with it, and it killed 14,700 people. That's in the 16th chapter of Numbers. All Israel saved? Doesn't sound like it, does it? Now, at the time that there was 19 years of constant warfare between the northern kingdom of Israel and the invading Assyrian armies, you may be sure that a lot of people were killed in that war. The Bible doesn't record the number who were killed, but in warfare as prolonged and as bitter as that. And remember, there was no pretense of being humane about warfare in those days. You may be sure a lot of them were killed. And similarly, in the bitter battles with the Babylonians when they came and conquered the southern kingdom of Judah, you may be sure that a lot were killed. All Israel has not been saved. Those who were obedient to God, yes. But just mere membership in the nation alone isn't going to get you by. Now, as to this matter of all that remain, let's see just what the Bible says. We'll take some representative samples here. In the Old Testament, practically always the words which are translated remnant are one of these three Hebrew words. First, peletah, which means escape. Or sherith, which again means escape, those who have gotten out safely. Or sarid, which means a survivor. When you get to the New Testament, remnant is either one of two Greek words, katelema, meaning a few, or lima, which, as I said, is derived from lipo, which means to be lacking in number, a very few. Every one of these things emphasizes the fact that it is a few, and it is just those few who have escaped disaster. Isaiah 10, verses 20 to 23, and a portion of this, verse 22, I believe it is the one that Paul quotes, or partly quotes, in Romans. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel and such as are escaped of the house of Israel shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. And that word remnant is she'or, one of these escaped remainders. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. Again, that's she'or. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. And that word consumption there is kilayon, which means destruction. The destruction decreed shall overflow with righteousness. For Yahweh, God of hosts, shall make a consumption even determined in the midst of all the land. And this second consumption, kalah, not only means destruction, but it means to consume completely. The thoroughness of it is what is emphasized in the meaning of the Hebrew word. Does this look like all Israel being saved? Now, it's entirely possible that they will be saved in a different way and in a different sense. That after getting their spanking here, and I mean they are going to perish in the judgment that comes upon this civilization, that in another world they will go through a period of probation and re-education, which may bring them in some distant time back into harmony with God, yes. But don't expect that sort of thing to come during your lifetime and here in this world, because that's not the way the Bible talks about it. So in Romans 10, verse 27, Paul quotes that, though the number of the children of Israel be as the sand of the sea, a remnant shall be saved. And it's that Greek word katelema, meaning only a few. In Isaiah 46, verses 3 and 4, "Hearken unto me, O house of Jacob, and all the remnant of the house of Israel, which are born by me from the belly, which are carried from the womb, and even to your old age, I am he, and even to gray hairs will I carry you. I have made, and I will bear, even I will carry and deliver you." But now that remnant of Israel, it's your Hebrew word, she'arif, those who have escaped. Again, Zephaniah 3, verse 13, "The remnant of Israel shall not do iniquity, nor speak lies, neither shall a deceitful tongue be found in their mouth. For they shall feed and lie down, and none shall make them afraid." And again, this is that Hebrew word, she'arif, those who have escaped. Jeremiah 31, verse 7, "For thus saith Yahweh, sing with gladness for Jacob, and shout among the chief of the nations. Publish ye, praise ye, and say, O Yahweh, save thy people, the remnant of Israel." And again, she'arif, those who have escaped. And finally, Joel 12, verse 32, "And it shall come to pass that whosoever shall call on the name of Yahweh shall be delivered. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem shall be deliverance, as Yahweh hath said, and in the remnant whom Yahweh shall call." And that word remnant there is the word sarid, a survivor. So, what we find from the Bible is this. God has one way of dealing with the other nations, and a different way of dealing with his people Israel. He has one way of dealing with the whole nation Israel, and he has another way of dealing with a selected group among the people of Israel, the remnant, the Kohol. Now, all Israel have always been divided into three classes. There were always among them, first, the hopelessly wicked, and God has periodically had to destroy them. You know the saying, one rotten apple spoils the barrel. And when you get too many more than one, it sure does it. And a few of these can spoil a community or a nation, as we see how a few of the rotten ones are spoiling our whole nation now. Then, at the other extreme, there have been the relatively good remnant, the Kohol. Not sinlessly perfect, of course. No mere man ever was. But of a standard of conduct above the rest, which showed they really were trying to follow God. And when you do that, he's willing to take care of the rest of it for you. Then the third class was the great mass, who were never very good, and only periodically became bad enough that they had to get a drastic lesson. Now, what is the purpose, then, of this great mass? Well, certainly God doesn't need them to accomplish most of his purposes. He's often accomplished this by just a few. In fact, you might say, nearly always. The Bible gives a few interesting examples. About 892 B.C., the Syrian king, Ben-Hadad, besieged the city of Samaria, the capital city of the northern kingdom, Israel. And this siege was carried on until there was extreme famine in the city. The king of Israel didn't dare lead his smaller army outside the city walls to fight with the enormous army of the Syrians. So finally, when things had reached the point of absolute despair. The prophet Elisha was in the city, and he said to them, this is all in the 7th chapter of 2 Kings, he said, thus saith Yahweh, tomorrow about this time shall a measure of fine flour be sold for a shekel, and 2 measures of barley for a shekel in the gate of Samaria. Why, you couldn't have bought them for 100 times their weight in gold at that time. So it says, then a lord on whose hand the king leaned answered the man of God and said, behold, if Yahweh would make windows in heaven, could this thing be? And Elisha said, behold, thou shalt see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not eat thereof. He had doubted God openly, publicly. It goes on to say there were 4 lepers at the entering in of the gate. Now, you know, in those days, a leper had to stay outside the camp or the city, lest others catch the disease from him. So sitting just outside the gate of the city were these 4 lepers. And they said one to another, why sit we here until we die? If we say, we will enter into the city, then the famine is in the city. And if we sit here, we die also. Now therefore come and let us fall unto the host of the Syrians. If they save us alive, we shall live. And if they kill us, we shall but die. And they rose up in the twilight to go unto the camp of the Syrians. And when they were come to the outermost part of the camp of Syria, behold, there was no man there. For Yahweh had made the host of the Syrians to hear a noise of chariots and a noise of horses, even the noise of a great host. And they said one to another, lo, the king of Israel has hired against us the kings of the Hittites and the king of the Egyptians to come against us. Whereupon they arose and fled in the twilight and left their tents and their horses and their asses, even the camp as it was, and fled for their life. And when these lepers came to the outermost part of the camp, they went into one tent and did eat and drink and carried thence silver and gold and raiment and hid it. Then they said one to another, we do not well. This is the day of good tidings, and we hold our peace. If we tarry till the morning light, some mischief will come upon us. Now therefore come, that we may go and tell the king's household. So in the darkness they went back to the city and battered on the gate till they aroused the guard and identified themselves and gave their news. And they were allowed into the city, and they told the king what they had found. Now this was according to Elisha's prophecy. The king wouldn't believe it. He said, see how clever these Syrians are, the trap they set for us. They're just trying to get us to go out of the city, out to the camp, and then they'll fall on us and kill us. Well, finally, somebody whose common sense or hunger, I'm not sure which, prevailed, told the king, we'll send a couple of scouts to find out. So that wasn't risking many people. The king stayed at home, and he sent a couple of scouts out to the camp of the Syrians. And they went out there in the early dawn light, and they went all through the camp, and nobody there. They went beyond it to where the flight of the Syrians had led them down toward Jordan. They wanted to get across the river. And all the way along here, it was littered with the things they had dropped, casting away their armor so it wouldn't impede them in their flight. So they came back and told the king. So the people rushed out to the camp of the Syrians, amply provided with food, and brought it back in. And as Elisha said, the price was down. There was abundance. Nobody had to pay much. Now this particular lord who had sneered at this, why, could God do this even if he opened the windows of heaven to drop it to us? The king had appointed him to command of the guard at the gate, on the side toward the Syrian camp. And in the rush of the people jamming through to go out and get that food, they trampled him to death. He saw some of this, but he didn't get to eat it. So the word of Elisha was made good. Now, if it hadn't been for these four lepers, the people would have stayed in the starving city until they died. So God didn't need an army to save Samaria. He used an illusion to create panic in the Syrian army, so they fled. And then the poorest remnant of all, four outcast lepers, did the rest. Well, at another time, because of their apostasy, God had allowed the entire 12-tribe nation of Israel, this was before they split up, had allowed the entire nation to be conquered and ruled by the kingdom of Midian for 7 years of very harsh rule. And then God commissioned Gideon to save Israel. He didn't go to the important people. He went to Gideon. And he said, "Almighty man, you are to save your people Israel." Gideon said, "With what could I save Israel? My father's house is but small in Benjamin, and I am the poorest of my father's family. How could I save Israel?" God said, "Go in this thy might. Have not I sent thee?" What? But Gideon wanted a sign. He said, "Lord, so that I shall know that you are really with me." He said, "Tonight I'm going to spread out a fleece, a lambskin fleece, on the ground. And if you really mean this now, let there be dew only on the fleece and none on the ground around it." So next morning he went out and took up the fleece and he wrung the whole bowl full of water out of it. But there was no dew on the ground around it. It was dry. In those days, they didn't know the saying, "I'm from Missouri," but they still had skeptics just the same. So he said, "Well, Lord, so I can really be sure, I'm going to put out this fleece again tonight, and this time let's make it the other way around. Let the fleece be dry and dew on the ground all around it." Which he did, and that's the way it was when morning came. The fleece was dry and heavy dew all around it on the ground. So that finally convinced him, and he set out a call for volunteers. Well, 32,000 men from the tribes of Manasseh and Zebulun and Asher gathered to him. Now, their law in those days, God's law, was different from